Disc 8.
They were understanding and helpful, I said, feeling my jaw stiffen with resentment. I hated that Halpern was using what had happened to Christine to unsettle me. Detective, were you officially back on active duty at the time of Detective Hampton's murder? Yes, I went back on full-time duty about a week before the murder. Was it requested that you stay off active duty for a while longer? It was left up to me. The Chief of Detectives did question my ability to resume my duties, but he made it my choice. Halpern nodded thoughtfully. He felt your head might be elsewhere? Who could blame you if it was? I was upset. I still am. But I've been able to work. It's been good for me. The right thing to do. There were several more questions about my state of mind, and then Halpern asked, When you found out that Detective Hampton had been murdered, how upset were you? I did my job. It was a bad homicide scene. Your client is a butcher. Do you really want to get him off? Do you realize what you're doing? Your fingerprints were on Detective Hampton's belt and on the dashboard of her car. Her blood was on your clothes. I paused for several seconds before I spoke again. Then I tried to explain. There was a huge, jagged tear in Detective Hampton's jugular vein. Blood was everywhere in the car, and even on the cement floor of the garage. I tried to help Detective Hampton until I was certain she was dead. That's why my fingerprints were in the car and Detective Hampton's blood was on my clothes. You tracked blood upstairs?
No, I did not.
I checked my shoes carefully before I left the garage. I checked twice. I checked because I didn't want to track any blood up into the building.
But you were upset. You admit that much. A police officer had been murdered. You forgot to put on gloves when you first searched the scene. There was blood on your clothes? How can you possibly be so sure?
I stared directly into his eyes and tried to be as calm as he was. I know exactly what happened that night. I know who killed Patsy Hampton in cold blood. He raised his voice suddenly.
No, you do not, sir. That's the point. You do not. In frisking Colonel Jeffrey Schaefer, isn't it fair to say that you were in physical contact with him?
Yes.
And isn't it possible blood from your clothes got onto his? Isn't it even likely?
I wouldn't give him an inch. I couldn't. No, it isn't possible. That blood was on Jeffrey Schaefer's trousers before I arrived. Halpern moved away from me. He wanted me to sweat. He walked over to the jury box, occasionally looking back at me.
He asked several more questions about the crime scene and then said,
But Dr. Cassidy didn't see any blood, and the two other officers didn't see any blood either. Not until after you came into contact with Colonel Schaefer. Colonel Schaefer was on the phone for 3 to 5 minutes before he met with his therapist. He went straight there from his children's birthday party. You have no evidence, Detective Cross, except what you brought into Dr. Cassidy's apartment yourself. You have absolutely no evidence, Detective. You arrested the wrong man. You framed an innocent man.
Jules Halpern threw up his hands in disgust.
I have absolutely no further questions.
Chapter 97. I took a back way out of the courthouse. I usually did that anyway, but on this day it was essential. I had to avoid the crowds and the press, and I needed to have a private moment to recover from my time in the witness stand. I just had my ass pretty well kicked by an expert ass-kicker. Tomorrow, Kathy Fitzgibbon would try to undo some of the damage in cross-exam. I was in no hurry as I walked down a back stairway that was used by maintenance and cleaning people in the building, and also served as a fire escape. It was becoming clear to me there was a chance Jeffrey Schaefer would be acquitted. His lawyers were the best, and we'd lost important evidence at the suppression hearing. And I had made a bad mistake at the homicide scene when, in my rush to help Patsy Hampton, I'd neglected to put on gloves. It was an honest mistake, but it probably created doubt in the minds of the jurors. I'd had more blood on me than Schaefer.
That was true. Schaefer might actually get away with murder, and I couldn't stand the thought. I felt like yelling as I descended the twisting flights of stairs. And that's exactly what I did. I yelled at the top of my voice, and it felt so damn good to get it out. Relief flowed through my body, however temporary it might be. At the bottom of the concrete stairs was the basement of the courthouse. I headed down a long, dark hallway toward the rear lot, where the Porsche was parked. I was still lost in my thoughts, but calmer after hollering my fool head off in the stairwell. There was a sharp bend in the hallway near the exit to the parking lot. I came around the turn and saw him. I couldn't believe it. The weasel was right there. He was the first to speak.
"What a surprise, Dr. Cross. Sneaking away from the madding, or is it maddening, crowd? Tail between your legs today? Don't fret. You did all right upstairs. Was that you yelling in the halls? Primal screams are the best, aren't they?"
"What the hell do you want, Schaefer?" I asked him. "We're not supposed to meet or talk like this." He shrugged his broad shoulders, wiped his blonde hair away from his eyes.
"You think I care about rules? I don't give a shit about rules. What do I want? My good name restored. I want my family not to have to go through any more of this. I want it all."
"Then you shouldn't have killed all those people, especially Patsy Hampton." Schaefer smiled.
"You're very sure of yourself, aren't you? You don't back down. I admire that, to a degree. I played the game of being a hero once myself, in the army. It's interesting for a while."
"But it's much more interesting to be a raving lunatic murderer," I said.
"See? You just don't back down from your bullheaded opinions. I love it. You're wonderful."
"It's not opinion, Schaefer. You know it, and so do I."
"Then prove it, Cross. Win your pitiful sodding case, will you? Beat me fair and square in a court of law. I even gave you a home court advantage."
I started to walk toward him. I couldn't help myself. He stood his ground. "This is all an insane game to you. I've met assholes like you before, Schaefer. I've beaten better. I'll beat you." He laughed in my face.
"I sincerely doubt it."
I walked right past him in the narrow tunnel. He pushed me, hard, from behind. He was a big man and even stronger than he looked. I stumbled, almost went over onto the stone floor. I wasn't expecting the outburst of anger from him. He held it in so well in court, but it was close to the surface. The madness that was Jeffrey Schaefer. The violence.
"Then go ahead. Beat me. See if you can," he yelled at the top of his voice. "Beat me right here, right now. I don't think you can, Cross. I know you can't."
Schaefer took a quick step toward me. He was agile and athletic, not just strong. We were almost the same size, 6'2 or 3, 200 pounds. I remembered that he'd been an army officer, then MI6. He still looked to be in excellent shape. Schaefer pushed me again with both hands. He made a loud grunting noise.
"If you've beaten better, then I should be a pushover. Isn't that so? I'm just a pushover."
I almost threw a punch. I wanted to. I ached to take him down, to wipe the smug, superior look off his face. Instead, I grabbed him hard. I slammed Schaefer up against the stone tunnel wall and held him there.
"Not now. Not here," I said in a hoarse, raw whisper. "I'm not going to hit you, Schaefer.
What, have you run to the newspapers and TV? But I am going to bring you down. Soon." He came out with a crazy laugh.
"You are fucking hilarious, do you know that? You're a scream! I love it!"
I walked away from Schaefer in the dark tunnel. It was the hardest thing I'd ever had to do. I wanted to beat the answers out of him, get a confession. I wanted to know about Christine. I had so many questions, but I knew he wouldn't answer them. He was here to bait me, to play.
"You're losing everything, he said to my back. I think I could have killed Jeffrey Schaefer on the spot. I almost turned, but I didn't. I opened the creaking door and went outside instead. Sunlight streamed into my eyes, half-blinding me for a dizzying moment. Shading my face with an arm, I climbed the stone stairs to the parking area, where I got another unwanted surprise. A dozen grim-faced members of the press, including some well-known reporters, were gathered in the back parking lot. Someone had alerted them. Someone had tipped them off that I was coming out this way. I looked back at the gray metal door, but Jeffrey Schaefer didn't come out behind me. He had retreated and disappeared back into the basement. Detective Cross, I heard a reporter call my name. You're losing this case. You know that, don't you? Yes, I knew. I was losing everything. I just didn't know what I could do to stop it. Chapter 98. The following day was taken up with my cross-examination by Catherine Fitzgibbon. Catherine did a good job of redressing some of the harm done by Jules Halpern, but not all of it. Halpern consistently broke up her rhythm with his objections. Like so many recent high-profile trials, this one was maddening. It should have been easy to convict and put away Jeffrey Schaefer, but that wasn't the case. 2 days later, we got our best chance to win, and Schaefer himself gave it to us, almost as if he were daring us. We now realized that he was even crazier than we'd thought. The game was his life. Nothing else seemed to matter. Schaefer agreed to take the stand. I think I was the only one in the courtroom who wasn't completely surprised that he was testifying, that he was playing the game right in front of us. Catherine Fitzgibbon was almost certain that Jules Halpern had advised, begged, and warned him not to do it. But there Schaefer was anyway, striding toward the witness stand, looking as if he had been called up there to be ceremoniously knighted by the Queen. He couldn't resist the stage, could he? He looked every bit as confident and in control as he had the night I arrested him for Patsy Hampton's murder. He was dressed in a navy blue double-breasted suit, white shirt, and gold tie. Not a single blonde hair was out of place, nor was there any hint of the anger that was boiling just under the surface of his meticulously groomed exterior. Jules Halpern addressed him in conversational tones, but I was sure that he felt uneasy about this unnecessary gamble. Colonel Schaefer, first I want to thank you for coming to the witness stand. This is completely voluntary on your part. From the very beginning you've stated that you've wanted to come here to clear your name. Schaefer smiled politely and then cut off his lawyer with a raised hand. The lawyers on both sides of the bar exchanged looks. What was happening? What was he going to do? I leaned way forward in my seat. It struck me that Jules Halpern might actually know that his client was guilty. If so, he wouldn't be able to cross-examine him. Legally, he couldn't ask questions that disguised the real facts as he knew them. This was the only way Schaefer could have his moment in the sun. A soliloquy. Once called to the stand, Schaefer could give a speech. It was unusual, but absolutely legal, and if Halpern knew that his client was guilty, it was the only way Schaefer could take the stand and not be incriminated by his own attorney. Schaefer had the floor.
If you will please excuse me, Mr. Halpern, I believe I can talk to these good people myself. I really can manage. You see, I don't need a lot of expert help to tell the simple truth.
Jules Halpern stepped back, nodded sagely, and tried to keep his poise. What else could he do under the circumstances? If he hadn't known before that his client was an egomaniac or insane, he surely knew it now. Schaefer looked toward the jury.
It has been stated here in court that I am with British intelligence, and that I was MI6, a spy. I'm afraid that I am actually a rather unglamorous agent. Double or nothing, if you will.
The light, well-aimed jab at himself drew laughter in the courtroom.
I am a simple bureaucrat, like so many others who toil away their days and nights in Washington. I follow well-established procedures at the embassy. I get approvals for virtually everything I do. My home life is simple and orderly as well. My wife and I have been married nearly 16 years. We love each other dearly. We are devoted to our 3 children. So I want to apologize to my wife and children. I am so frightfully sorry for this hellish ordeal they've had to go through. To my son Rob and the twins Tricia and Erica, I'm so sorry. If I'd had any idea what a circus this would become, I would have insisted on maintaining diplomatic immunity rather than trying to clear my name, our name, their name. While I'm making heartfelt apologies, I'll make one to all of you for being a bit of a bore right now. It's just that when you're accused of murder, something so heinous, so unthinkable, you want desperately to get it off your chest. You want to tell the truth more than anything else in the world. So that's what I'm doing today. You've heard the evidence, and there simply isn't any. You've heard character witnesses, and now you've heard from me. I did not kill Detective Patsy Hampton. I think you all know that, but I wanted to say it to you myself. Thank you for listening, he said, and bowed slightly in his seat. Schaefer was brief, but he was poised and articulate, and unfortunately very believable. He always held eye contact with the jury members. His words weren't nearly as important as the way he delivered them. Catherine Fitzgibbon came forward to do the cross-examination. She was careful with Schaefer at first. She knew he had the jury on his side for the moment. She waited until near the end of her cross-exam to go after Schaefer where he might be most vulnerable.
Your statement was very nice, Mr. Schaefer. Now, as you sit before this jury, you claim that your relationship with Dr. Cassidy was strictly professional, that you did not have a sexual relationship with her, correct? Remember, you are under oath. Yes, absolutely. She was, and hopefully will continue to be, my therapist. Notwithstanding the fact that she admits to having a sexual relationship with you?
Schaefer held his hand out toward Jules Halpern, signaling for him not to object.
I believe that the court record will show that she did not admit to such.
Fitzgibbon frowned.
I don't follow. Why do you think she didn't answer counsel?
Schaefer shot back.
That's so obvious. Because she didn't care to dignify such a question. And when she hung her head, sir, and looked down at her lap, she was nodding assent.
Schaefer now looked at the jury and shook his head in amazement.
You misread her completely. You miss the point again, Counselor. Allow me to illustrate, if I may. As King Charles said before being beheaded, give me my cloak, lest they think I tremble from fear. Dr. Elizabeth Cassidy was deeply embarrassed by your associate's crude suggestion, and so was my family, and so am I.
Jeffrey Schaefer looked at the prosecutor with steely eyes. He then acknowledged the jury again.
And so am I.
Chapter 99. The trial was almost over, and now came the really hard part, waiting for the verdict. That Tuesday, the jurors retired to the jury room to commence their deliberations in the murder trial of Jeffrey Schaefer. For the first time, I allowed myself to actually think the unthinkable, that Schaefer might be set free. Samson and I sat in the rear row of the courtroom and watched the 12 members depart, 8 men and 4 women. John had come to court several times, calling it the best and sleaziest show this side of the Oval Office, but I knew he was there to give me support. The son of a bitch is guilty. He's mad as little Davy Berkowitz, Samson said as he watched Schaefer. But he has a lot of good actors on his side. Doting wife, doting mistress, well-paid lawyers, silly Billy. He could get away with it.
It happens, I agreed. Juries are hard to read, and getting harder.
I watched as Schaefer courteously shook hands with members of his defense team. Jules and Jane Halpern both had forced smiles on their faces.
They know, don't they? Their client is the Weasel, a mass murderer. Jeffrey Schaefer has the ability to make people believe in him when he needs to. He's the best actor I've seen, I said. Then John left and I snuck out the back way again. This time, neither Schaefer nor the press was lying in wait downstairs or in the rear parking lot. In the lot I heard a woman's voice, and I stopped moving. I thought it was Christine. A dozen or so people were walking to their cars, seemingly unaware of me. I felt fevered and hot as I checked them all. None of them was her. Where had the voice come from? I took a ride in the old Porsche and listened to George Benson on the CD player. I remembered the police report about Schaefer's thrill-seeking ride that ended near DuPont Circle. It seemed a strangely appealing prospect. I took my own advice not to try to guess how the jury would decide the case. It could go either way. I let myself think about Christine, and I choked up. It was too much. Tears began to stream down my cheeks. I had to pull over. I took a deep breath, then another. The pain in my chest was still as fresh as it had been the day she disappeared in Bermuda. She had tried to stay away from me, but I wouldn't let her. I was responsible for what had happened to her. I drove around Washington, riding in gently aimless circles. I finally reached home more than 2.5 hours after leaving the courthouse. Nana came running out of the house. She must have seen me pull into the driveway. She'd obviously been waiting for me. I leaned out of the driver's side window. The DJ was still talking congenially on public radio. "What is it, old woman? What's the matter now?" I asked Nana.
"Miss Fitzgibbon called you, Alex. The jury is coming back. They have a verdict."
Chapter 100. I was apprehensive as could be, but I was also curious beyond anything I could remember. I backed out of the driveway and sped downtown. I got back to the courthouse in less than 15 minutes. The crowd on E Street was even larger and more unruly than it had been at the height of the trial. At least a half dozen Union Jacks waved in the wind. Contrasting with them were American flags, including some painted across bare chests and faces. I had to push and literally inch my way through the crush of people up close to the courthouse steps. I ignored every question from the press. I tried to avoid anyone with a camera in hand or the hungry look of a reporter. I entered the packed courtroom just before the jury filed back inside. "You almost missed it," I said to myself. Judge Fesco spoke to the crowd as soon as everyone was seated.
"There will be no demonstrations when this verdict is read. If any demonstrations occur, marshals will clear this room immediately," he instructed in a soft but clear voice.
I stood a few rows behind the prosecution team and tried to find a regular breathing pattern. It was inconceivable that Jeffrey Schaefer could be set free. There was no doubt in my mind that he'd murdered several people, not just Patsy Hampton, but at least some of the Jane Does as well. He was a wanton pattern killer, one of the worst, and had been getting away with it for years. I realized now that Schaefer might be the most outrageous and daring of all the killers I'd faced. He played his game with the pedal pressed to the floor. He absolutely refused to lose.
"Mr. Foreman, do you have a verdict for us?" Judge Fesco asked in somber tones.
Raymond Horton, the foreman, replied, "Your Honor, we have a verdict." I glanced over at Schaefer, and he appeared confident. As he had since the trial began, he was dressed today in a tailored suit, white shirt, and tie. He had no conscience whatsoever. He had no fear of anything that might happen to him. Maybe there was a partial explanation for why he'd run free for so long. Judge Fesco looked unusually stern.
"Very well. Will the defendant please rise?"
Jeffrey Schaefer stood at the defense table, and his longish blonde hair gleamed under the bright overhead lighting. He towered over Jules Halpern and his daughter Jane. Schaefer held his hands behind him, as if he were cuffed. I wondered if he might have a pair of 20-sided dice clasped in them, the kind I had seen in his study. Judge Fesco addressed the foreman again.
"As to count one of the indictment, aggravated premeditated murder in the first degree, how do you find?"
The foreperson,
"Not guilty, Your Honor."
I felt as if my head had suddenly spun off. The audience packed into the small room went completely wild. The press rushed to the bar. The judge had promised to clear the room, but he was already retreating to his chambers. I saw Schaefer walk toward the press, but then he quickly passed them by. What was he doing now? He noticed a man in the crowd and nodded stiffly in his direction. Who was that? Then Schaefer continued toward where I was, in the fourth row. I wanted to vault over the chairs after him. I wanted him so bad, and I knew I had just lost my chance to do it the right way.
"Detective Cross," he said in his usual supercilious manner. "Detective Cross, there's something I want to say. I've been holding it in for months."
The press closed in. The scene was becoming smothering and claustrophobic. Cameras flashed on all sides. Now that the trial had ended, there was nothing to prevent picture-taking inside the courtroom. Schaefer was aware of the rare photo opportunity. Of course he was. He spoke again so that everyone gathered around us could hear. It was suddenly quiet where we stood, a pocket of silence and foreboding expectation.
"You killed her,"
he said, and stared deeply into my eyes, almost to the back of my skull.
"You killed her."
I went numb. My legs were suddenly weak. I knew he didn't mean Patsy Hampton. He meant Christine. She was dead. Jeffrey Schaefer had killed her. He had taken everything from me, just as he'd warned me he would. He had won. Chapter 101. Schaefer was a free man, and he was enjoying the bloody hell out of it. He'd wagered his life. He had gambled, and he had won big time. Big time! He had never felt anything quite like this exhilarating moment following the verdict. Schaefer accompanied Lucy and the children to a by-invitation-only press conference held in the pompous, high-ceilinged grand jury room. He posed for countless photos with his family. All of them hugged him again and again, and Lucy couldn't stop crying like the brain-dead, hopelessly spoiled and crazy child she was. If some people thought he was a drug abuser, they'd be shocked by Lucy's intake. Christ, that was how he'd first learned about the amazing world of pharmaceuticals. He finally punched his arm into the air and held it there as a mocking sign of victory. Cameras flashed everywhere in the room. They couldn't get enough of him. There were nearly 100 reporters wedged into the room. The women reporters loved him most of all. He was a legitimate media star now, wasn't he? He was a hero again. A few gate-crashing agents of fame and fortune pressed their cards at him, promising obscene amounts of money for his story. He didn't need any of their tawdry offers. Months before, he had picked out a powerful New York and Hollywood agent. Christ, he was free as a bird. He was absolutely flying now. After the press conference, claiming concern for their safety, he sent his wife and children ahead without him. He stayed behind in the court law library and firmed up book deal details with Jules Halpern and representatives from the Bertelsmann Group, now the most powerful book publishing conglomerate in the world. He had assured them that they would get his story, but of course they weren't going to get anything close to the truth. Wasn't that the way with the so-called tell-all, bear-all nonfiction published these days? The Bertelsmann people knew this, and still they'd paid him dearly. After the meeting, he took the slow-riding lift down to the court's indoor car park. He was still feeling incredibly high, which could be dangerous. A set of 20-sided dice was burning a hole in the pocket of his suit trousers. He desperately wanted to play the game. Now, the Four Horsemen. Or better yet, Solipsis, his version of the game. He wouldn't give in to that urge, though. Not yet. It was too dangerous, even for him. Since the beginning of the trial, he had been parking the Jaguar in the same spot. He did have his patterns, after all. He'd never bothered to put coins in the meter, not once. Every day there was a pile of $5 tickets under the windshield wiper. Today was no exception. He grabbed the absurd parking tickets off the windshield and crumpled them into a ball in his fist.
Then he dropped the wad of paper onto the oil-stained concrete floor.
"I have diplomatic immunity," he said aloud, and smiled as he climbed into his Jag.
Book 5. Endgame. Chapter 102.
Schaefer couldn't believe it. He had made a very serious and perhaps irreversible mistake. The result wasn't what he had expected, and now his whole world seemed to be falling apart. At times he thought it couldn't have been any worse had he gone to prison for the cold-blooded murder of Patsy Hampton. Schaefer knew that he wasn't just being paranoid or mad. Several of the pathetic wankers inside the embassy watched him every bloody time he stepped out of his office. They seemed to resent and openly despise him, especially the women. Who had turned them against him? Somebody surely was responsible. He was the white English O.J. Simpson, a weird off-color joke to them, guilty though proven innocent. So Schaefer mostly stayed inside his office with the door closed, sometimes locked. He performed his few remaining duties with a growing sense of irritation and frustration and a sense of the absurd. It was driving him mad to be trapped like this, to be a pathetic spectacle for the embassy staff. He idly played with his computer and waited for the game of the Four Horsemen to resume, but the other players had cut him off. They insisted that it was too dangerous to play, even to communicate, and not one of them understood why this was the perfect time to play. Schaefer stared out onto Massachusetts Avenue for interminably long stretches during the day. He listened to call-in talk shows on the radio. He was getting angrier and angrier. He needed to play. Someone was knocking on the door of his office. He turned his head sharply and felt a spike of pain in the back of his neck. The phone had begun to ring. He picked up and heard the temp he'd been assigned. Ms. Wynne Hamerman was on the intercom. "Mr. Andrew Jones is here to see you," she said.
"Andrew Jones?" Schaefer was shocked. Jones was a hotshot director from the security service in London. Schaefer hadn't known he was in Washington. What the hell was this visit about? Andrew Jones was a high-level, very tough prick who wouldn't just drop by for tea and biscuits. Mustn't keep him waiting too long. Jones was standing there, and he looked impatient, almost furious. What was this about? His steely blue eyes were cold and hard. His face was as rigid as that of an English soldier posted in Belfast. In contrast, his brilliant red hair and mustache made him look benign, almost jolly. He was called Andrew back in London.
"Let's go inside your office, shall we? Shut the door behind you," Jones said in a low but commanding voice.
Schaefer was just getting past his initial surprise, but he was also starting to lose it. Who did this pompous asshole think he was to come barging into his office like this? By what right was he here? How dare he? The toad? The glorified lackey from London?
"You can sit down, Schaefer," Jones said, another imperious command. "I'll be brief and to the point."
"Of course," Schaefer answered. He remained standing.
"Please do be brief and get to the point. I'm sure we're both busy."
Jones lit up a cigarette, took a long puff, then let the smoke out slowly.
"That's illegal here in Washington," Schaefer goaded him.
"You'll receive orders to return to London in 30 days' time," said Jones, as he continued to puff on his cigarette. "You're an embarrassment here in Washington, as you will be in London. Of course, over there the tabloids have recreated you as a martyr of the brutal and inefficient American police and judicial systems. They like to think of this as DC Confidential, more evidence of wholesale corruption and naivete in the States. Which we both know, in this case, is complete crap."
Schaefer sneered.
"How dare you come in here and talk to me like this, Jones? I was framed for a heinous crime I didn't commit. I was acquitted by an American jury. Have you forgotten that?"
Jones frowned and stared him down.
"Only because crucial evidence wasn't allowed in the trial. The blood on your trousers? That poor woman's blood in the bathroom drain at your mistress's?"
He blew smoke out the side of his mouth.
We know everything, you pathetic fool. We know you're a stone-cold killing freak. So you'll go back to London and stay there until we catch you at something. Which we will, Schaefer. We'll make something up if we have to. I feel sick to my stomach just being in the same room with you. Legally, you have escaped punishment this time, but we are watching you so very closely now. We will get you somewhere, and someday soon.
Schaefer looked amused. He couldn't hold back a smile. He knew he shouldn't, but he couldn't resist the play.
You can try, you insufferable sanctimonious shit. You can certainly try. But get in line. And now, if you please, I have work to do.
Andrew Jones shook his head.
Well, actually, you don't have any work to do, Schaefer. But I am happy to leave. The stench in here is absolutely overpowering.
When was the last time you bathed?
He laughed contemptuously.
Christ, you've completely lost it.
Chapter 103. That afternoon, I met with Jones and three of his agents at the Willard Hotel near the White House. I had called the meeting. Sampson was there, too. He'd been reinstated in the department, but that didn't stop him from doing what had originally gotten him into trouble.
I believe he's crazy, Jones said of Schaefer. He smells like a commoded boot camp. He's definitely going down for the count. What's your take on his mental state?
I knew Jeffrey Schaefer inside and out by now. I'd read about his family, his brothers, his long-suffering mother, his domineering father. Their travels from military base to military base until he was 12. Here's what I think. It started with a serious bipolar disorder, what used to be called manic depression. He had it when he was a kid. Now he's strung out on pharmaceutical drugs. Xanax, Benadryl, Haldol, Ativan, Valium, Librium, several others. It's quite a cocktail. Available from local doctors for the right price. I'm surprised he can function at all. But he survives. He doesn't go down. He always wins.
I told Jeff he has to leave Washington. How do you think he'll take it? Jones asked me. I swear his office smelled as if a dead body had been festering there for a couple of days.
Actually, his disorder can involve an accompanying odor, but it's usually steely, like metal. Very pungent, sticks to your nostrils. He probably isn't bathing, but his instincts for playing the game, for winning and surviving, are amazing, I said. He won't stop.
What's happening with the other players? Sampson inquired. The so-called horsemen. They claim that the game is over, and that it was only a fantasy game for them, Jones told him. Oliver Highsmith stays in touch, mostly to keep tabs on us, I'm sure. He's actually a scary bastard in his own right. Says he's saddened by the murder of Detective Hampton. He's still not 100% sure that Schaefer is the killer. Urges me to keep my mind open on that one.
Is your mind open on it? I asked, looking around the room at the others. Jones didn't hesitate.
I have no doubt that Jeffrey Schaefer is a multiple murderer. We've seen enough and heard enough from you. He is quite possibly a homicidal maniac beyond anything we've ever known. And I also have no doubt that eventually he's going down.
I nodded my head. I agree, I said, with everything you just said, but especially the homicidal maniac part. Chapter 104. Schaefer was talking to himself again that night. He couldn't help it, and the more he tried to stop, the worse it became. The more he fretted, the more he talked to himself.
They can all bugger off. Jones, Cross, Lucy and the kids, Boo Cassidy, the other spineless players. Screw them all. There was a reason behind the Four Horsemen. It wasn't just a game. There was more to it than simple horseplay.
The house at Calorama was empty, much too quiet at night. It was huge and ridiculous, as only an American house can be. The original architectural detail, the double living room, the six fireplaces, the long-ago dead flowers from Astor Florist, the unread books in gold and brown leather bindings, Lucy's Marmite. It was driving him up the 12-foot-high walls. He spent the next hour or so trying to convince himself that he wasn't crazy. More specifically, that he wasn't an addict. Recently, he'd added another doctor in Maryland to his sources for the drugs. Unfortunately, the illegal prescriptions cost him a fortune. He couldn't keep it up forever. The lithium and Haldol were to control his mood swings, which were very real. The Thorazine was for acute anxiety, which was fucking bloody real as well. The Narcan had also been prescribed for his mood swings. The multiple injections of Loradol were for something else, some pain from he couldn't remember when. He knew there were good reasons, too, for the Xanax, the Compazine, the Benadryl. Lucy had already fled home to London, and she'd taken the traitorous children with her. They'd left exactly 1 week after the trial ended. Her father was the real cause. He'd come to Washington and spoken to Lucy for less than an hour, and she'd packed up and left like the goody two-shoes she'd always been. Before she departed, Lucy had the nerve to tell Schaefer she'd stood by him for the sake of the children and her father, but now her duty was over. She didn't believe he was a murderer, as her father did, but she knew he was an adulterer, and that she couldn't take for one moment longer. God, how he despised his little wifey. Before Lucy left, he made it clear to her that the real reason she'd performed her duty was so he wouldn't reveal her unsavory drug habit to the press, which he would have done, and still might do anyway. At 11 o'clock, he had to go out for a drive, his nightly constitutional. He was feeling unbearably jittery and claustrophobic. He wondered if he could control himself for another night, another minute. His skin was crawling, and he had dozens of irritating little ticks. He couldn't stop tapping his goddamn foot. The dice were burning a bloody hole in his trouser pocket. His mind was racing in a dozen haphazard directions, all of them very bad. He wanted to, needed to, kill somebody. It had been this way with him for a long time, and that had been his dirty little secret. The other horsemen knew the story. They even knew how it had begun. Schaefer had been a decent English soldier, but ultimately too ambitious to remain in the army. He had transferred into MI6 with the help of Lucy's father. He thought there would be more room for advancement in MI6. His first posting was Bangkok, which was where he met James Whitehead, George Baer, and eventually Oliver Highsmith. Whitehead and Baer spent several weeks working on Schaefer, recruiting him for a specialized job. He would be an assassin, their own personal hitman for the worst sort of wet work. Over the next 2 years, he did 3 sanctions in Asia, and found that he truly loved the feeling of power that killing gave him. Oliver Highsmith, who ran both Baer and Whitehead from London, once told him to depersonalize the act, to think of it as a game. And that was what he did. He had never stopped being an assassin. Schaefer turned on the CD in the Jag, loud, to drown out the multiple voices raging in his head. The old-age home rockers Jimmy Page and Robert Plant began a duet inside the cockpit of his car. He backed out of the drive and headed down Tracy Place. He gunned the car and headed up close to 60 in the block between his house and 24th Street. Time for another suicidal drive? He wondered. Red lights flashed on the side of 24th Street. Schaefer cursed as a D.C. police patrol car eased down the street toward him. God damn it! He pulled the Jag over to the curb and waited. His brain was screaming. Assholes! Bloody impertinent assholes! And you're an asshole, too! He told himself in a loud whisper. Show some self-control, Jeff. Get yourself under control. Shape up. Right now! The Metro Patrol car pulled up behind him, almost door to door. He could see 2 cops lurking inside. One of them got out slowly and walked over to the Jag's driver's side window. The cop swaggered like a hot shit all-American cinema hero. Schaefer wanted to blow him away. Knew he could do it. He had a hot semi-automatic under the seat. He touched the grip, and God, it felt good.
"License and registration, sir," the cop said, looking unbearably smug. A distorted voice inside Schaefer's head screeched, "Shoot him now. It will blow everybody's mind if you kill another policeman." He handed over the requested identification, though, and managed a wanker's sheepish grin.
"We're out of Pampers at home. Trip to the 7-Eleven was in order. I know I was going too fast, and I'm sorry, officer. Blame it on baby brain. You have any kids?"
The patrolman didn't say a word. Not an ounce of civility in the prick. He wrote out a speeding ticket. Took his sweet time about it. "There you go, Mr. Schaefer." The patrol officer handed him the speeding ticket and said, "Oh, and by the way, we're watching you, shithead. We're all over you, man. You didn't get away with murdering Patsy Hampton. You just think you did." A set of car lights blinked on and off, on the side street where the patrol car had been sitting a few moments earlier. Schaefer stared, squinted back into the darkness. He recognized the car, a black Porsche. Cross was there, watching. Alex Cross wouldn't go away. Chapter 105. Andrew Jones sat next to me in the quiet, semi-darkened cockpit of the Porsche. We'd been working closely together for almost 2 weeks. Jones and the security service were intent on stopping Schaefer before he committed another murder. They were also tracking War, Famine, and Conqueror. We watched silently as Jeffrey Schaefer slowly turned the Jaguar around and drove back toward his house. "He saw us. He knows my car," I said. "Good." I couldn't see Schaefer's face in the darkness, but I could almost feel the heat rising from the top of his head. I knew he was crazed. The words homicidal maniac kept drifting through my mind. Jones and I were looking at one, and he was still running free. He'd already gotten away with one murder. Several murders.
"Alex, aren't you concerned about possibly putting him into a rage state?" Jones asked as the Jaguar eased to a stop in front of the Georgian-style house.
There were no lights on in the driveway area, so we wouldn't be able to see Jeffrey Schaefer for the next few seconds. We couldn't tell if he'd gone inside. "He's already in a rage state. He's lost his job, his wife, the children, the game he lives for. Worst of all, his freedom to come and go has been curtailed. Schaefer doesn't like having limitations put on him. Hates to be boxed in. He can't stand to lose."
"So you think he'll do something rash?"
"Not rash. He's too clever. But he'll make a move. It's how the game is played."
"And then we'll mess with his head yet again?"
"Yes, we will. Absolutely." Late that night, as I was driving home, I decided to stop at St. Anthony's. The church is unusual in this day and age, in that it's open at night. Monsignor John Kelleher believes that's the way it should be, and he's willing to live with the vandalism and the petty theft. Mostly, though, the people in the neighborhood watch over St. Anthony's. A couple of worshippers were inside the candlelit church when I entered, around midnight. There are usually a few parishioners inside. Homeless people aren't allowed to sleep there, but they wander in and out all through the night. I sat watching the familiar red votive lamps flicker and blink. I sucked in the thick smell of incense from benediction. I stared up at the large gold-plated crucifix and the beautiful stained-glass windows that I've loved since I was a boy. I lit a candle for Christine, and I hoped that somehow, some way, she might still be alive. It didn't seem likely. My memory of her was fading a little bit, and I hated that. A column of pain went from my stomach to my chest, making it hard for me to breathe. It has been this way since the night she'd disappeared, almost a year ago. And then, for the first time, I admitted to myself that she was gone. I would never see her again. The thought caught like a shard of glass in my throat. Tears welled in my eyes. "I love you," I whispered to no one. "I love you so much, and I miss you terribly." I said a few more prayers,
Then I finally rose from the long wooden pew and silently made my way toward the doors of the vestibule. I didn't see the woman crouching in a side row. She startled me with a sudden movement. I recognized her from the soup kitchen. Her name was Magnolia. That was all I knew about her. Just an odd first name. Maybe a made-up one. She called out to me in a loud voice.
"Hey, peanut butter man! Now you know what it's like."
Chapter 106. Jones and Sandy Greenberg from Interpol had helped get the other three horsemen under surveillance. The net being cast was large, as the catch could be if we succeeded. The huge potential scandal in England was being carefully watched and monitored by the security service. If four English agents turned out to be murderers involved in a bizarre game, the fallout would be widespread and devastating for the intelligence community. Schaefer dutifully went to the embassy on Wednesday and Thursday. He arrived just before 9 and left promptly at 5. Once inside, he stayed out of sight in his small office, not even venturing out for lunch. He spent hours on America Online, which we monitored. Both days, he wore the same gray slacks and a double-breasted blue blazer. His clothes were uncharacteristically wrinkled and unkempt. His thick blonde hair was combed back. It looked dirty and greasy, and resisted the high winds flowing through Washington. He looked pale, seemed nervous and fidgety. Was he going to crash? After dinner on Friday night, Nana and I sat out in the back of the house on Fifth Street. We were spending more time together than we had in years. I knew she was concerned about me, and I let her help me as much as she wanted, for both our sakes. Johnny and Damon were washing the dishes inside and managing not to squabble too much. Damon washed while Johnny dried. Damon's tape deck played the beautiful score from the movie Beloved.
"Most families have a dishwasher and dryer these days," Nana said, after she'd taken a sip of her tea. "Slavery has ended in America, Alex. Did you happen to hear about that?"
"We have a dishwasher and dryer, too. Sounds like they're in good working order. Low maintenance, low cost. Hard to beat." Nana clucked.
"See how long it lasts."
"If you want a dishwasher, we can buy one. Or are you just practicing the fine art of being argumentative before you launch into something more deserving of your talents? As I remember, you are a fan of Demosthenes and Cicero." She nudged me with her elbow.
"Wise apple," she said. "Think you're so smart."
I shook my head. "Not really, Nana. That's never been one of my big problems."
"No, I suppose not. You're right. You don't have a big head about yourself."
Nana stared into my eyes. I could almost feel her peering into my soul. She has an ability to look very deeply into things that really matter.
"You ever going to stop blaming yourself?" she asked me. "You look just terrible."
"Thank you. Are you ever going to stop nagging me?" I asked, smiling at her. Nana could always bring me out of the doldrums in her own special way. She nodded her small head.
"Of course I will. I'll stop one day. Nobody lives forever, Granny son."
I laughed. "You probably will, though. Live longer than me or the kids." Nana showed lots of teeth. Her own, too.
"I do feel pretty good, considering everything," she said. "You're still chasing him, aren't you? That's what you're doing nights. You and John Sampson, that Englishman Andrew Jones."
I sighed. "Yeah, I am. And we're going to get him. There may be four men involved in a series of murders. Here and in Asia, Jamaica, London." She beckoned me with a bent, crabbed forefinger.
"Come closer now."
I grinned at her. She's such a soft touch, really, such a sweetie, but such a hard ass, too. "You want me to sit down on your lap, old woman? You sure about that?"
"Good Lord, no. Don't sit on me, Alex. Just lean over and show some respect for my age and wisdom. Give me a big hug while you're at it."
I did as I was told, and I noticed there wasn't any fuss or clatter coming from the kitchen anymore. I glanced at the screen door and saw that my two little busybodies were watching, their faces pressed against the mesh wire. I waved them away from the door, and their faces disappeared.
"I want you to be so very, very careful,"
Nana whispered as I held her gently.
"But I want you to get him somehow, some way. That man is the worst of all of them. Jeffrey Schaefer is the worst, Alex. The most evil."
Chapter 107.
The game had never really ended, but it had changed tremendously since the trial in Washington. It was 5:30 in the evening in London, and Conqueror was waiting at his computer. He was both anxious and feverishly excited about what was happening. The Four Horsemen was starting up again. It was 1:30 a.m. in Manila, in the Philippines. Famine was ready for a message and a new beginning to the game he loved. And War awaited news of the Four Horsemen at his large house on the island of Jamaica. He, too, was obsessed with how it would end and whether he would be the winner. It was 12:30 in Washington. Jeffrey Schaefer was driving fast to the White Flint Mall from the embassy. He had a lot to accomplish that afternoon. He was revved and manic. He sped up Massachusetts Avenue, past the British Embassy and the Vice President's house. He wondered if he was being followed and supposed it was possible. Alex Cross and the other police were out there, just waiting to get him. He hadn't spotted them yet, which only meant that they were getting serious now. He made a quick right, hit a traffic circle, and shot onto Nebraska Avenue, heading toward American University. He snaked round back roads near the university, then got on Wisconsin and sped toward the mall. He entered Bloomingdale's and found the department store sparsely peopled. A little depressing, actually. Good. He despised the American shopping scene anyway. It reminded him of Lucy and her brood. He walked at a leisurely pace through the men's clothing section. He picked up a few overpriced Ralph Lauren polo sports shirts, then two pairs of dark trousers. He draped a black Giorgio Armani suit over his arm and took the bundle into the changing rooms. At a security desk inside, he handed the clothes to an attendant on duty, posted there to curtail shoplifters, no doubt. "Changed my mind," he said. "That's no problem, sir." Schaefer then jogged down a narrow corridor that led to a rear exit. He sprinted toward the glass doors and burst through them into a parking lot in back. He saw signs for Bruno Cipriani and Lord and Taylor, and he knew he was headed in the right direction. A Ford Taurus was parked there near the F-pole. Schaefer jumped inside, started it, and drove up the Rockville Pike to Montrose Crossing, a little over a mile away. He didn't think anyone was following him now. He passed Montrose and went north to the Federal Plaza Shopping Center. Once there, he entered the Cyber Exchange, which sold new and used software and lots of computers. His eyes darted left and right until he saw exactly what he needed. "I'd like to try out the new iMac," he told the salesperson who approached him. "Be my guest. You need any assistance, holler," the salesperson said. "It's easy." "Yes, I think I'm fine. I'll call if I get stuck. I'm pretty sure I'm going to buy the iMac, though." "Excellent choice." "Yes, excellent, excellent." The lazy clerk left him alone, and Schaefer immediately booted on. The display model was connected online. He felt a rush of manic excitement, but also a tinge of sadness as he typed in his message to the other players. He'd thought this through, and knew what had to be said, what had to be done. "Greetings and salutations. This glorious and unprecedented adventure of 8 years, the Four Horsemen, is nearly at an end now. You have stated your case very logically, and I accept the regrettable conclusion you've reached. The game has become too dangerous, so I propose that we create an unforgettable ending. I believe that a face-to-face meeting is a fitting end. It's the only conclusion that I can accept. This was inevitable, I suppose,
and we have discussed it many times before, you know where the game ends. I propose that we start play on Thursday. Trust me, I will be there for the grand finale. If necessary, I can begin the game without you. Don't make me do that. Death. Chapter 108. At 9 o'clock on Monday morning, Schaefer joined the monotonous, stomach-turning line of workaday morons stuck in traffic going in the direction of Embassy Row. He had the intoxicating thought that he would never again have to work after today. Everything in his life was about to change. He couldn't go back. His heart was pounding as he stopped and waited at the green light on Massachusetts Avenue near the embassy. Car horns beeped behind him, and he was reminded of his suicide run a year ago. Those were the days, damn it. Then he blasted through on the red. He ran. He had rehearsed his escape. This was for keeps. He saw two blocks of clear roadway ahead, and he floored the gas pedal. The Jaguar leaped forward with raw, phallic power, as it were. The sports car rocketed toward the puzzle of side streets around American University. 10 minutes later, he was turning into the White Flint Mall at 50, gunning the Jag up to 55, 60, 65, as he sped across the mostly empty lot. He was sure no one had followed him. He drove toward a large Borders Books and Music store, turned right, then zoomed up a narrow side lane between buildings. There were 5 exits out of the mall that he knew of. He accelerated again, tires squealing. The surrounding neighborhood was a warren of narrow streets. Still no one was behind him, not a single car. He knew of a little-used one-way entrance onto the Rockville Pike. He got on the road, heading out against the barrage of traffic streaming to work in the city. He hadn't spotted any cars speeding behind him inside the mall, or on the side streets, or on the pike. They probably had only one car, or at most two, on him in the morning. That made the most sense to Schaefer. Neither the Washington Metro Police nor the Security Service would approve a larger surveillance detail to follow him. He didn't think they would, anyway. He'd probably lost them. He whooped loudly and started blaring the Jag's horn at all the pathetic suckers and fools stuck in the oncoming lanes, headed for work. He'd been waiting nearly 8 years for this. It was finally here. Endgame. Chapter 109. "We've still got him?" I asked Jones, nervously looking around at the half-dozen agents working in the crisis room inside the British Embassy. The room was filled with state-of-the-art electrical equipment, including 6 video monitors. "Still got him. He won't get away that easily, Alex. Besides, we think we know where he and the others are going now." We had a tiny, sophisticated homing device on the Jaguar, but there was a reasonable chance that Schaefer would discover it. So far, he hadn't. And now he was running in the Jag, running with the bait. At least, that was what we thought was happening. The horsemen were all on the move. Oliver Highsmith had been followed from his home in Surrey to Gatwick Airport, outside London. Agents at the airport made sure that Conqueror got on the British Air flight to New York, then called Washington to report he was en route. A couple of hours later, an agent phoned from the Philippines. George Bayer was at Ninoy Aquino Airport in Manila. Famine had purchased a ticket to Jamaica with a stopover in New York. We already knew that James Whitehead had retired to Jamaica and that he was on the island now. War was waiting for the others to arrive. "I'm trying to get a fixed pattern for the Four Horsemen game, but there are several points of view at work." "That's what they like about the game. What makes it so addictive," I said to Jones as we waited for more information to come in. "We know that at least 3 of them have been playing the game since they were stationed in Thailand in 91. Around that time, bar girls and prostitutes began to disappear in Bangkok. The local police didn't spend much time on the investigations. Girls in Potpol had disappeared before. The police have somewhat the same attitude here in Washington with respect to the Jane Doe killings. These girls didn't mean much. They were written off. Murders and disappearances in Southeast certainly aren't investigated like ones in Georgetown or on Capitol Hill. It's one of Washington's dirty little secrets."
Jones lit a new cigarette off the butt of his last one. He puffed, then said, "It might be just Schaefer who's involved in the actual murders, Alex. Either that or the others are much more careful than he is." I shrugged my shoulders. I didn't think so, but I didn't have enough concrete evidence to argue my case effectively with Jones, who was himself no slouch as a detective.
"The end of the Four Horsemen is coming, right? Can they really end their little fantasy game?" Samson asked. "It sure looks like they're getting together," I said. "Four former British agents, four grown men who love to play diabolical games. In my opinion, four murderers."
"Possibly."
Andrew Jones finally admitted that the unthinkable could be true.
"Alex, I'm afraid you could be right."
Chapter 110.
Jamaica must have been chosen because it was relatively private and because James Whitehead owned a large beach house there. But perhaps there were other angles attached to the game of the Four Horsemen. I hoped that we would know soon enough. Oliver Highsmith and George Bayer arrived on the island within minutes of each other. They met at the baggage claim inside Donald Sangster Airport, then drove for about an hour to the posh Jamaica Inn in Ocho Rios. We were on the move, too. Samson and I had gotten there on an early morning flight from D.C. The weather was glorious. Blue skies, warm breezes. We heard strains of English and Jamaican Creole at the airport. Reggae and ska. The rustle of the banana trees as the sea breeze rushed through them was like a soft chorus. The hotel in Ocho Rios was very private and old-fashioned, just 45 rooms overlooking the sea. We arrived there simultaneously with four English teams. There were also two teams of detectives from Kingston. The English High Commission office in Kingston had been alerted about our presence and our purpose here.
This book is continued on Disc 9.